when you migrate to a new country, you are starting from scratch often, you know? And when you start from scratch without a lot of support, you really are on survival mode. And I think that, you know, necessity is the mother of creativity. So you just get into the hustle of how do we make this work? And that's why there's so many immigrants that are entrepreneurs, because you see an opportunity where other people might not see it, but it's purely out of necessity more than like, you know, the privilege of like, oh, let me just start a business. It's just like, we need to make something work because we need some financial stability.
Hey everyone, welcome to Honey and Hustle. I am your host, Angela Hollowell. And in this episode, I am speaking with Angela Salamanca. She is a serial entrepreneur founding the likes of Gaio, Synthrol, Exfoto, and probably some more that we're gonna explore here in this episode. Throughout this, you will learn how to turn your labor of love into a legacy of inclusion.
Hey, thanks so much for joining us today. This podcast is free and will always be free and available on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, Good Pods, Heytai, you name it. While it's free for you to consume, it's not free for us to create. We pay our video editors, writers, production assistant, and operations manager for helping us make this show come to life. If you'd like to support us in making this show, please consider subscribing to our Substack community, using our affiliate links, or just simply sharing the show with someone who might enjoy it. All right, let's get into this conversation.
You started Synthrol and Exfoto, which is now here in the Durham Food Hall, which is really awesome. Talk to me a little bit about how your relationship with Mexican food and Latin-inspired food, if you will, like what aspects of that you tried to bring into your restaurants?
So I am Colombian, and I've been living in this country for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And I've worked in the industry pretty much that whole time.
Okay.
And 30 years ago when I got here, I was working with my family who had a Mexican restaurant.
Okay.
So that's how I learned about the industry.
Okay.
And they, you know, just by working there, I just kind of fell in love with the culture and the cuisine. I was really young at the time. I was 17 years old. So I was, you know, like the world of living by myself and like working in a restaurant and making money for myself.
Mm-hmm.
It just, the world just opened up.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the opportunity to travel to Mexico. And when I did that, like that really just sealed the deal for me. I really fell in love with everything that had to do with Mexico.
Okay.
I think part of the reason was because, you know, coming from Colombia as a young person, I never really had the opportunity to travel and experience another culture as a tourist.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got to the state, I wasn't really a tourist. I was an immigrant trying to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
So you really experience a place differently when you go as a tourist.
Yeah.
And I think that was the first time I fell in love with Mexican culture, Mexican cuisine, mezcal.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the opportunity to open Synthrol or dream about Synthrol in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I just, it was an opportunity for me. Once we opened in 2007, it was an opportunity for me to explore all that love that I had for the culture. I'm a very creative person, I'm an artist.
Mm-hmm.
So I also had an opportunity to like really, you know, look into it from that perspective.
Yeah.
And I was doing it with this really clear intention of I wanted to create something that was long lasting for the sake of my family. I have two young daughters.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to have something that was long-lasting, that could be a source of, you know, like nourishment and financial stability for us as a family.
It also answers why I thought you were Mexican, because like your love of that cuisine definitely shines through in those restaurants. And I think even going to Exfoto, which is where I kind of first was introduced to you, and like the style of food that you kind of bring, it is not Tex-Mex.
You know what I'm saying? It is definitely something that is distinct. And so when you talk about your time in Mexico, the only place I've ever been in Mexico was Puerto Vallarta. Okay. My cousin that lives there was like, oh no, you gotta go to Mexico City, you gotta eat your way through Oaxaca, you have to have all these different experiences, because this is just one slice, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I think that, you know, some people believe that, you know, cultures are a monolith, and they're just not, right? Mm-hmm. So what was your experience like in Mexico that just was so profound for you? Like, what are some of the foods that you ate and things like that?
So where we went was Oaxaca. And Oaxaca is just like this really magical town that offers all kinds of just beautiful experiences. So we ate really good moles. We took a couple cooking classes. We went to all the markets. And it was just, you know, it was just so special to be able to be with the natives, go to the markets, talk about ingredients, and then come to their homes, cook these really beautiful, elaborate meals, and then share bread with them. So I know we had lots of moles, we had lots of tacos, lots of corn-based things, tamales. Yeah. But I think what was so beautiful about it is that everything was really simple. You know, there wasn't, this wasn't like a luxury trip. It was just, it was basic, but everything was genuine and delicious. And I think also, you know, going back to my earlier point, I was really a tourist. So I think that when you are in a place for the first time with an open heart, like you can really take things and value them in just a different way. And it was just, it was so, so special. I remember eating squash blossoms for the very first time in my life. And they were stuffed with ricotta or like requesón, which is what they called, you know, ricotta there. And then we made this very simple tomatillo salsa with some avocado on top of a fresh tostada. Like that bite was just like magic, you know? And it was simple, but it was beautiful. And I had never had anything like that in the States or back home. Mm. I just didn't eat that way. Mm. So I think the simplicity and authenticity of everything was just so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, bringing that back has been what has always inspired me into opening new places. So the story behind Ex Voto is that I partner with Marshall, who's worked with me for a long time, at a project called Gallo Pelon, which is a mezcal bar in downtown Raleigh. So we partnered to open Ex Voto, and Ex Voto was meant to be a nixtamal place. So we were going to be cooking all of our corn and making our own tortillas and tamales, making our own masa, and trying to sell that as well. And we did a year of pop-ups all over the triangle, very successful. And then March 2020 hit. We were supposed to be open at the Durham Food Hall in April, ended up having to open in May of 2020 and pivot our whole operation from grinding corn to what can we do with these sets? Maybe that's what you're picking up, that this is not quite just Tex-Mex. Right. Because we had all these sets for tamales and for tacos, but we knew we could not grind our own corn without the labor. Yeah. And at the time, you know, what we thought was gonna be a bigger operation in terms of employees and concept ended up having to be driven by two people in a space that was brand new for us. So the pivot was, well, we can make burritos, so let's switch. And then my partner Marshall was like, well, we could try to like create something like a crunch wrap. Mm-hmm. And he started playing with the idea, and we moved our sets into the crunch wrap, which is what we actually do now. Mm-hmm. So we had to put the corn making, you know, the nixtamal process of what we wanted to do on a shell and say, this is what actually works with the staff that we have. And it ended up working at the hall as a concept. So it was kind of like necessity and luck. Mm-hmm. And that's what Expo 2 is today.
Yeah, yeah, I love it. When I think about like Exphoto Central and probably even the new space that's coming in Raleigh again, there's kind of a difference between the way the spaces are set up, right? Mm-hmm. So Exphoto is in a food hall. Mm-hmm. So not primarily, people aren't necessarily going to the food hall just for Exphoto. They're going to get food mm-hmm. and to have options
yeah.
and to sit and be with their friends so they can all accommodate each other and like be together in one space, right? And so when we think about food as a mechanism for a community, right? How have you guys kind of played around with this concept of like, you know, farm to table, food to table, not just with the food, but also with the customer experience, right? So they, not only the next time they come, they remember like, no, we're going for Exphoto the next time.
I mean, I think it's a combination of things. Being in the hall has been a really interesting experience because it takes, you know, whenever you're selling anything, it doesn't matter what it is. What's going to set you apart is the quality of your product, but also the guest interaction. Mm-hmm. So if you can get one of those right, you have a win. If you can get both of those right, you have a double win. Mm-hmm. And I think that's some of what we try to do at Exphoto, at Centro, at Gallo, and hopefully at the new place mm-hmm. That is coming up in Gateway. It's making sure that the quality of the product that we have, it's exactly what we want, that there's consistency in it, and that guest interaction is special. So folks remember, it's like, oh, we had this really great meal and our server was really amazing, or our hostess was really attentive, or the bartender was really interesting, you know, like trying to hit those two opportunities to make a little bit of a difference. And I think that, you know, we've been fortunate enough at the hall that we've been able to create a niche and been able to really, really drive those two things. Mm-hmm. To the point that, you know, I think that we're one of the most popular offerings at the hall.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, I can testify, okay. talking a little bit about Gallo Pelon, which is a very interesting concept. Mm-hmm. I had them for the first time last year. Mm-hmm. So that was my first time at a Mezcal, inspired spot. First time drinking Mezcal. Now we have two Mezcal spots in Durham, mm-hmm. right? So like within the last 6 months to a year, you know, we've kind of brought that on. And I think that people are very surprised by having kind of a specialty cocktail bar with amazing food, like how much people really flock to that. Because mm-hmm. Gallo Pelon also isn't a big space. Yeah. It's two stories, but it's not a big space. Always packed out. And I think that, you know, if you look at something like a Young Hearts Distillery, which is also in that area, you look at something like a Transfer Co. Food Hall, which also has specialty drinks, and you think about like the drinking experience and the food experience, right? And how Gallo Pelon is really kind of this like, everything is intentional, it feels like. You know, the drinks can match the food, you know, and they can make food and drink pairings, right? That's almost this intimate food experience that you probably wouldn't expect to get at just a restaurant. You would expect to pay for, you know, an Airbnb experience, like this curated experience. And you mm-hmm. guys have kind of brought that into Gallo Pelon. And I know I sound like an ad for this restaurant, but what I'm trying to get at is like, when we think about, you know, really niching down, if you will, or just getting really specific mm-hmm. about the things that we want to create and the experiences that we want to provide, and how in some ways that could alienate people and you know, for people who just like, oh, I don't like Mezcal, I'm not going to go to this restaurant, even though it's more than the Mezcal. Like, talk to me a little bit about, you know, how you guys thought about Gallo Pelon from its inception. Like, we know this is a very specific cultural experience that people who have never been outside the country or to Mexico probably haven't had but prior to coming to us. Mm-hmm. So how can we really give them this full, authentic, genuine, intimate, you know, experience that they want to come back for?
I think for us, So like I said earlier, you know, I think that for me, what drives opening any concept, any offering, it has to do with like, oh my God, like I love this. Mm-hmm. How can I bring this back to my community, mm-hmm. and have them in at any level experience the same magic of this? Mm-hmm. And with mezcal was the same thing. You know, we went to Oaxaca, we went to a Palenque, and we had lots of mezcal, and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Why don't we have more mezcal in North Carolina? Mm-hmm. So we came back and said, let's open a mezcal bar. Mm-hmm. So Gallo Pelon is on the second floor of the building that houses Centro too.
Okay.
So we're only on the second floor. And we had that space open, mm-hmm. and it needed to be developed. So we said, you know, this is a very intimate space. We could create a small patio that would be really, really special and unique. Mm-hmm. And let's do it. Mm-hmm. And it was hard. It was hard to do. Not just because construction was difficult, long, super expensive, but then bringing mezcal as a mainstream offering was really difficult, because you know all the liquor that you buy as a business needs to go through the state, mm-hmm. and they have an inventory of what's available, mm-hmm. and their inventory of mezcal was non-existent. So we had to really work with them to say, hey, we want to bring this. Can you find it and bring it into your inventory? And we had to do that with pretty much every single brand that we currently carry. Mm-hmm. So we really were pioneers when it came to that, but it was hard, because mm-hmm. We had to do a lot of special orders. Special orders work, at least in Wake County. I don't know how it works in Durham, but you have to pay for what you want in advance. Mm-hmm. And wait for them to bring it. And you can wait up to a year. Mm-hmm. So you have to put all this money out there and inventory that you don't even have. Mm-hmm. So it was truly a labor of love, mm-hmm. and passion. Mm-hmm. It still continued to be that. We like for the folks that work at Gallo to be educated on mezcal and to be ambassadors of that spirit. So when you go there, you can get a full-on class if you want on what we have and how to taste it and why this is different than that. Or you can just have a nice, unique, intimate, romantic cocktail experience. And then we've added food to that. Since we reopened back up from the pandemic, we've added a heftier menu to Gallo. But yeah, you know, I think that, and I hate to like make assumptions, but from experience, a lot of people's experiences with drinking agave spirits, tequila mostly, are spring break, nonsense, chugging lots of shots of tequila, and then blackout, yeah. Insane hangovers, and they would never drink tequila again because of that. Mm-hmm. So we get a lot of those people. I mean, I'm sure if you ask around, there's like the majority of folks have had an experience like that. So for us, it's been like, whoa, 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 okay, that is a way to drink an agave spirit. Mm-hmm. You were probably drinking something that was highly, you know, like that contained a lot of sugar. So let's take it back.
Yeah.
Can we sip it? Can you drink something that is 100% tequila, 100% agave? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just different. You know, when you sit there and you sip things and then you maybe have a little bit of bite of orange and then try a different expression, it's just a different, you know, it's a much more intimate, intentional, mm-hmm. experience. This is not meant to get anybody drunk. Mm-hmm. So it kind of, it slows down time, and that is just by itself just going to yield for a different outcome, you know?
Time is an interesting word that you used a couple of times. You said, you know, it referenced how long it takes to get mezcal sometimes, mm-hmm. and liquor in general, because you have to go through a middleman essentially. You referenced the time it took to create this restaurant. But yet, none of these things have ever stopped you from creating a new restaurant, right? Right? Yeah. So I think sometimes we talk about time as if it is a precious resource, and we should talk about it like that, but we also talk about it as if, like, we have to do everything right now. Like, everything has to be right now. And if it's not right now, then I'm failing. If it's not right now, then I'm doing something wrong. If it's yeah. not right now, then I'm late. And, I mean, time is just so relative, you know, because that time is going to pass anyway.
Well, and as you get older, you get, you know, you start to gain perspective. How are you using your time? And some good things take time to build and grow. And yeah, so, yeah, it's an interesting concept. I'm very appreciative of it. People's times.
So I'm going to switch gears for a little bit here, because I'm seeing your shirt, the Run for Love 5K, which is put on by Trophy, if I'm, yeah Trophy mm-hmm. Brewing, good folks. But you also have your own 5K, mm-hmm. and it's actually commemorate a holiday that's coming up, Day of the Dead, Day yes. of the Dead 5K, Dia de los Muertos 5K, which is also a big Mexican holiday. I'm not sure if they celebrate that in Colombia. No? Mm-hmm. See, okay.
It is a Mexican holiday. Yeah. Originally, there's a lot of people, there's a lot of places in Latin America that celebrate something like that because, I'll let you finish and then I have so much to say.
Yeah. So. This, right, you didn't make it necessarily in honor of the holiday. You made it in honor of an event that happened in your life with someone that you love and care about deeply. And so for you, kind of taking a break away from using food to express yourself and your life experiences, talk to me a little bit about why you decided to start a 5K and fundraising 5K in honor of that event.
Yes, so my sister Margarita passed away 20 years ago this October. And, you know, it's one of the hardest things I've ever had to experience. We were really close. She committed suicide when she was 25 years old, and she was under my care, and I was 26. Very hard time. And I think that dealing with grief, it's not a thing that I knew how to deal. I didn't know how to do it at the time. And living in this culture at the time, I had already been living here for 10 years, there wasn't a lot of spaces where I felt safe to talk about, first of all, the way that she died, mm-hmm. and second of all, you know, everything that I was feeling. Mm-hmm. So I carry that grief with me for a long time, kind of like unresolved, and then I became a mother, and then when you become a mother, like just anything and everything just stays on pause, and then you just have to tend to your children. So everybody isn't surviving. And then when I opened the restaurant, I remembered our staff said, hey, we would like to set up an ofrenda for Dia de Muertos. And I was like, I have no idea what that is, but what do you guys need? I'm super game. Yeah. And they're like, we would like to set it up on this wall of the restaurant. And I was like, sure. Mm-hmm. So I got them all the things that they asked and came back, and they had set up the most beautiful ofrenda mm-hmm. I have ever seen, like in the middle of the restaurant. Mm-hmm. And they all brought pictures of their family that had passed and some, you know, like candy and some bread, some pan de muerto and some sodas and some things. And we gather around and we had this moment of sharing. They were sharing with me this tradition that was really special for them. And it gave me an opening to say, this is a way that I can come back to this thing that has been on hold for so long. And the fact that it was like colorful and communal felt safe, you know? So after that, we did, for the next few years, we did a few other different events around Dia de Muertos, but we knew we wanted to have a bigger audience. Because every time we talked about it, you know, like we would bring people to show them the ofrenda And some people were like really uncomfortable and some people were really open. So we really knew we wanted to have a bigger audience, and a 5K seemed like a good way to do that. Plus I'm also a runner. So I was like, you know, we could run, we could do this, and let's find somewhere, somebody in our community that we could benefit with this. And at the time, as a business, I didn't feel like we were giving back to the Latin American community enough. So that's what we partnered with the Boys and Girls Club of Brentwood, because they were really servicing and still continue to serve the Latin American community in that area with their after school program. So it just, you know, like it just kind of all fell into place, and we've been doing it for 10 years. And with every year we learned something new. And last year we decided to give the race to the club. Mm-hmm. So now the club is, this is the first year that they're championing doing the race. I'm still in the advisory committee and helping them with fundraising. But this year was a year that I said, hey, I really want you guys to take this over. And it's happening October 28th. So we're on full force of marketing, trying to get people registered. And it's just, it's such a beautiful event. We've learned so many things. How to put an event of that size, which is crazy. And all the little things that have come out of it, getting the kids from the club to train for a 5K, mm-hmm. whether it's Day of the Dead or not, like mm-hmm. that in itself has been a huge accomplishment. Mm-hmm. Because you see kids from 5 to 18 mm-hmm. that have trained and are ready and go out there. And whether it's an easy run for them or a hard run for them, they're all cheering for one another. And it is just the most beautiful thing to see. We get a lot of people that dress up and come and run the race in a full-on Day of the Dead attire. And that is inspiring itself, and it's really exciting. We have families that come and run the race in honor of somebody that they have lost. And then we've been able to raise, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars for the club. So it's been a really beautiful thing that it's kind of like evolved from this, you know, from this first idea of like, oh, let's do this, let's kind of create more awareness. And this gives me personally an opportunity to like continue to like grief, move through the grief, but also celebrate her memory and talk about death with my kids. And with my nieces, with my neighbors, and with the bigger community. And it's been really wonderful. Something that is happening this year is that by giving the race to the club, I've made a little bit of space to create something new. And I've never been to Mexico for the Day of the Dead. But I'm always looking to what they're doing, right? And they're just this massive, beautiful celebrations in the cemeteries. Mm-hmm. And we set up a small ofrenda at the cemetery, at the Oakwood Cemetery every year, mm-hmm. because we run through the cemetery. Mm-hmm. So as you entered, we always have an ofrenda there. And the ofrenda has grown over the years mm-hmm. because folks come and they make offerings. So, you know, we have hundreds of pictures that people have left there over the years, and we always save them and we always put them back up. We have lots of trinkets that people leave there in honor of their folks that have died. So this ofrenda has grown and grown and grown, and I've been really wanting to have a big, big, massive ofrenda. Just like a, just something that you walk in and you're like, whoa. So we partner with a local artist, and we're creating a crazy art installation that is going to involve two big ofrendas mm-hmm. And about four small ofrendas that other partners are going to make. And the idea is that we're going to take over this big field at the cemetery and just transform it mm-hmm. Into a Dia de Muertos celebration. We're calling it Dia de Oakwood because it's at the Oakwood Cemetery. Yeah. And that's going to happen from October 27 to November 2nd. And we just started making 3,000 paper flowers for the installation. So we're going to be celebrating Dia de Muertos with the rays and with this new festival that it's, you know, it'll be the first one in North Carolina. And we're really excited to see what that's going to turn out like.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds incredible. That sounds amazing. I'm so happy that you were able to continue with it, because I can only imagine what that first run was like for you.
Oh my God. I mean, and it still is, you know, it's so emotional, but it's so rewarding. And I think that we, God, especially after COVID, like, we need all the spaces that we can have where we can talk about grief, mm-hmm. and where we can talk about loss, and where we can talk about death, and where we can also celebrate the small little wins, you know? Because I think that what's in the way of us speaking about grief and loss and death is that it feels really heavy, because it is.
Yes.
But when you can move through it, you can also speak about, celebrate the memories of the people that you have loved. And that's how you actually keep them closer to you. Mm-hmm. And then there's room for joy. And that remembrance, while it's still going to be sad and heavy at times, it can be really beautiful too. And, you know, it's the one thing that we all know it's going to happen.
Yeah.
We're here at one moment, and then we won't be. So death is the one certainty that we all have in this world. So being able to create bigger spaces where folks can come and talk about and feel safe and say, oh, you know what? Like, I do want to share this story about my grandfather, mm-hmm. or about my dog, or about my mother. And be helped by the space and others that are feeling the same thing that you're feeling. Like, I mean, what's more community than that?
Yeah.
And we are in such a need of that. So we hope that these is going to contribute to that. Mm-hmm. And we will see. We don't know. We will see.
I love it. I love it. So two things I kind of want to dive into from just your story and some things that you've been mentioning here and there that I want to tie together, first of which is the Latino community in Raleigh. Have you always been in Raleigh since you lived in the States or in the Triangle area?
I've been all over. The longest I've been in Raleigh, I was in Raleigh for 5 years, and then I moved to Chapel Hill, then went to Apex, to Cary, to South Durham, and then I've been back in Raleigh for about 12 years.
Okay, so the Triangle, mostly, so, North Carolina, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, what has been your experience engaging with the Latino community here, or Latinx community here, outside of the restaurants, and like the restaurants you've worked at and the restaurants you've created?
You know, it's a growing community. I think it's a community that work so hard, and even though it's such a force within our community, it's still really invisible. Mm-hmm. But I see a lot of signs of hope with representation and diversification, mm-hmm. a lot more outside of Raleigh than, like, Durham, for example.
Mm-hmm. So to help you kind of orient this question, the reason I ask mm-hmm. is because I'm also wondering, like, you came here as an immigrant, started a business, but that couldn't have been easy, because it's not like you had like $20,000 sitting in the bank for you, right? So like, how are people, do you think, like, gaining access to knowledge about, if they want to start their own business in the Latinx community, do they have resources that are, you know, Spanish language resources? Do they have access to mentorship and capital and banks and things like that?
So I think things that have shifted from the time that I arrived and opened the restaurant to now is that we have Latin American banks, right? So they are really focused into helping our community in that way. We have Centro Latino mm-hmm. and other organizations such as that are really focusing on mentoring and helping folks with any kind of entrepreneurial, you know, quest. So I think those resources were not existent before. I know that our community colleges also have resources now that are in both languages to help folks in terms of business and things like that. So there's a lot more resources. I think that when it comes to immigrants, whether they're Latin American or Asian or otherwise, you know, immigrants have these survival switch turned on, because when you migrate to a new country, you are starting from scratch often, you know? And when you start from scratch without a lot of support, you really are on survival mode. And I think that, you know, necessity is the mother of creativity. So you just get into the hustle of how do we make this work? And that's why there's so many immigrants that are entrepreneurs, because you see an opportunity where other people might not see it, but it's purely out of necessity more than like, you know, the privilege of like, let me just start a business. It's just like, we need to make something work because we need some financial stability. So I see that over and over. I think our living in a smaller community, it's a benefit, because then you have a little bit more access to resources than bigger cities. But it's still a hustle, you know? I just had a really interesting experience of wanting to finance a new project that we have in Gateway in partnership with other folks that are in the industry. We collectively have 20 years of experience in the industry, and trying to get a loan was almost nearly impossible.
Wow. 20 years, and you still can't get a loan.
I mean, we still don't have the loan. Hopefully we will by next week, but it has, you know, this was harder than I ever thought it was going to be. And, you know, a lot of them was like, oh, you don't have to take it personal. It's just the, you know, it's the bank industry, it's the moment that we are, it's after COVID. I'm like, I get all that. It's still hard to know that after 20 years, it takes this much of effort to get a loan when, you know, it's a proven concept. I want to believe that it is, and hopefully once we're open, it will be. But I don't know. The point of entry is hard, regardless. We're doing this through an SBA loan, and man, those SBA loans are still hard to get. You know, our first original loan with Central was an SBA loan, a Small Business Association loan. And it was hard to get it at the time. It's still hard to get. So I don't know that it's gotten easier, which is unfortunate.
That is unfortunate, yeah. Well, try to give you a story of hope. There wasn't one. So you've mentioned you have two daughters, and you mentioned the youth that run in the Day of the Dead 5K. I kind of want to talk to you about your, you know, experience and kind of your just relationship with the youth and why you feel it's so important to have them involved in life and in these tough conversations about, you know, these are the things that I've experienced.
I think if we are actually going to change the world, it's going to have to be with the kids. I don't want to be sarcastic about us grown-ups, but, you know, people are set in their ways, and it's just harder change. But when you plant the seeds of, you know, like healthy lifestyles, running is a good thing. That yields things. We've seen it. We've seen it with the kids at the club. Like, they're training when they're little, and as they move in through the different programs of the club, like, some of the things that they talk about as big moments have been running the race because of their sense of accomplishment. You know, they work hard to train, and then they showed up to this event, and then they were able, with their friends, to complete this thing and feel so, you know, just accomplished. And like that builds their self-esteem, and it's just like a little snowball. So I think that we have such an opportunity with youth to plant seeds of change. And we need a lot of that. You know, we need to be healthier. We need to be more vulnerable. We need to talk about death. We need to talk about how to be more involved in our communities. And if we don't get the kids to see these things, they're just gonna not see them. It's hard to do that when our audience now, it's so consumed by electronics that I think it's kind of an urgent thing that we really need to prioritize. It's like, how do we get these kids to, and I get that that's how they communicate and there's no going back, but like, how do we get them to also, you know, like to also pay attention to this? The importance of having deep, present conversations, the importance of moving it, to be in your body every day, you know, like, and I really do think that children, we don't give them enough credit, but it's also our responsibility to like guide them. That's why we're the grown-ups, right? So I've always seen them as such an opportunity for what's possible that we haven't been able to accomplish. And as a mother, you know, like if I'll ever have a legacy, hopefully it will be the life that my kids are gonna live, and what they will do with their communities once they're, you know, they're on their own.
Yeah. And you kind of started with that too, like you view your businesses and just your career and your life as a legacy that you're leaving for your kids. But you also view your kids as part of your legacy in that they get to see what's possible with you. They get to see you go through these hard times and go through these hard times, you know, and come out of it a stronger person. And understanding that, again, like at some point I'm gonna die, but until then, I'm gonna keep moving towards, you know, the things that I really want, things that I feel like are important. When you think about legacy, you know, if you had to think about, you know, not including money, not including just how big the restaurants get, like what are some of the big moments in your life that you really want to be impressed upon people, you know, through your business and through your time as a business owner?
I think inclusion, you know, that everybody can feel safe and welcomed. I think that when that is present in a space, people can really be their best. So I've always been a champion of inclusivity and safety. Maybe because I'm a woman, maybe because I'm an immigrant, maybe because I'm a mother of two women. But that has always been something that is really important to me. I think building community through shared experiences. So cooking together, eating together, dancing together, being together, creating events together. I think it's also something that I've been able to do a lot, and you know, sometimes things don't go as planned, but just, you know, the act of just spending time with people, problem solving and dreaming things, it's such intimacy just creates community.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just go around it. So I would say this too, and I do hope that whenever I'm not around anymore, people can say, yeah, that crazy woman, you know, that always wanted to dance and drink and do these crazy things about Dia de los Muertos, like, we actually do miss her.
Mm-hmm.
Like that energy is no longer here.
Mm-hmm.
And that maybe the kids hopefully will do some of it, not all of it. I don't want to, you know, burden them with things that they don't want to do, but maybe some of it.
Just a few things, just the crazy lady parts, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I always joke with them that when I'm gone, they better set up an altar de muertos for me, and it better be luscious and beautiful, because otherwise I'll come back and like pull their feet when they're sleeping. And they're like, we'll do it, don't worry.
Okay. Well, before we let you get out of here, I have a few rapid fire questions for you. Do you think you're up for the challenge? Mm-hmm. Awesome. What has been your favorite business resource that you find yourself recommending to people all the time?
You know, I think I have to go back to the very basics. Like, I am a calendar lover. So I'm always letting, you know, I'm like, if you want to be efficient, you need to get it on the calendar. And just getting organized that way. So I live by my calendar. If it's not there, it does not exist. But it's helpful in terms of being efficient and productive. And it also allows for me to have spaces for the things that I know I need to do so I can be the best person for, you know, for this. Yeah. So allow time for walks with my friends or, you know, all the other things that I need to do. So I think a good tight calendar that is full of all good things, you know, work things, but play things. It's an important resource for business.
What painful business experience are you most grateful for?
I think that learning that I can't do it all by myself and feeling serious burnout to the point of physical exhaustion where my body was shutting down and having to rely on the team to do the things, right? Mm-hmm. That was hard.
That sounds rough. Yeah, that sounds terrible, actually. But at least you had a good team that was able to help you out.
Yeah, and you know, it's really helped me change and shift my mentality around work. You know, like there is a team, and everybody has a responsibility in the team, and we all hold each other accountable for what we're supposed to do. And that allows for a lot more balance and a lot more just like bandwidth. And I don't have to do it all.
Yeah. Good. So you kind of answered this one, but I want to ask anyway, what habits have you had to remove from your life since starting your own businesses?
I go to bed as close to 10 o'clock at night as I can. I hydrate constantly. I drink a lot of water, and some of it, it's full of vitamins, full of hydration things. Like, so I try to really hydrate a lot. I move every day, whether it's a run or a walk or the gym or yoga or something, or cycling or something, but I move intentionally every day. I pray every day. And I have a gratitude practice. So I always try to like write down what I'm grateful for, because I know there's always at least one thing, even when it's hard, really, really hard, there's always something to be grateful for.
Yeah, there is. Can agree with that. What is the costliest business decision that you would make again?
Oh. I mean, I don't know that I would have, everything that I've done has been costly and kind of irrational and crazy. I think that it's really afforded me so much, some financially, but I've made some really wonderful friends over the course of this crazy ride. We've been able to do some really creative and beautiful things. So I think all of it.
All of it.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate you sharing with me today. We got deep, we got vulnerable, we got foodie. It was amazing. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much.
That's all for today's episode. And if you can't wait for the next episode, you can subscribe to our paid membership on Substack to get exclusive content like outtakes, bloopers, after show thoughts, and more. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to give us a 5-star rating on your app of choice or like this video on YouTube. We'll catch you in the next episode.